Good morning. I call the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order on Tuesday, February 14th, 2023. A quorum is present. We are going to have approval of the minutes next. Representative Kosnick, would you like to make a motion to approve the minutes for February 9th?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move the minutes.
Thank you. Representative Kosnick moves the approval of the minutes for February 9th, 2023. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of adopting the minutes of February 9th, 2023, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February 9th, 2023 are approved. The first order of business for our bills today is for Representative Ryer. Oh, there you are. Good morning, Representative Ryer. I'm going to ask that we have this bill wrapped up by 9 a.m. at the very latest. Okay. So Representative Ryer is here to present House File 383. Since Representative Ryer is not a member of this committee, I will move that House File 383 be recommended to be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, Representative Ryer, we have your bill before us. If you would please speak to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. And thank you for the note about timing. I know that that timing is also very important to my testifiers as they have another commitment at 9. So I'm here today to talk about House File 383, a bill that adopts the recommendations from the January 2021 Advisory Task Force on State Employment and Retention of Employees with Disabilities. This task force included representatives of 9 state agencies as well as MMB. The cost to implement is $102,000 in fiscal year 2024 and $60,000 per year thereafter. This bill means a lot to me. I ran for office, as I'm sure we all did, to make a difference and to make the world a better place. House File 383 does this by implementing the straightforward but very important recommendations that you'll hear about in a moment. The essence of the bill is the state of Minnesota needs to do better to have a workplace where people with disabilities can succeed. Right now, we fall short. However, I'm convinced that as a state government, we have the will to make the changes that are required. These changes are embodied in the recommendations that, and I will quote the task force report, will demonstrate the state of Minnesota's commitment to the hiring, retention, and advancement of people with disabilities by modernizing outdated and potentially discriminatory language, creating more clarity and consistency, and adding capacity for essential equity work. I'd like to thank the task force participants for their hard work from 2019 to 2021, including through the height of the pandemic. My thanks too to Deed and MMB for working through details on this bill. Next, Trevor Turner from the Minnesota Council on Disability will explain the bill in more detail. Thank you. I look forward to your questions and ask for your support for this bill.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Trevor Turner, if you'd please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Cleaborn. My name is Trevor Turner, and I am the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. Minnesota Council on Disability was actually one of the chairs of the task force that created the recommendations that ultimately led to this bill that we have before us today. And we're leading efforts to increase disability representation in the Minnesota state government workforce. We request that the House State Government Finance and Election Committee make this bill a priority in 2023 legislative session, and we believe that more people, more disability representation in our state enterprise, especially those in leadership positions, will lead to better decisions being made around state disability policies. House File 383 would codify the recommendations made by the Advisory Task Force on the Employment and Retention of Employees with Disabilities. The task force was created in 2019 and deliberated for about 2 years and released the report in February of 2021. 2021. In addition, this bill revises the Minnesota State Statute 43A, which governs the hiring and retention of employees. Finally, this bill would demonstrate the state of Minnesota's commitment to the hiring, retention, and advancement of people with disabilities by modernizing outdated and potential discriminatory language, creating more clarity and consistency on disability employment policy, training, educating, hiring managers, and providing support structure for employee disabilities and adding capacity for equity work. So this bill does the following. It codifies the executive order from Governor Dayton and Governor Walz, which gave instruction to state agencies to create plan to increase the representation of people with disabilities in our state enterprise system. In 1999, we had a low of about 4% of people with disabilities working for our state government. After Governor Dayton's executive order, it increased to about 8%. However, it's really hard to determine if that was actually because of hiring or hiring new people with disabilities, or if older employees that aged into having a disability. So that's one of the things that this bill would address, is creating a better data collection structure that would allow for us to have a better understanding of why people with disabilities are not represented in our state enterprise system. It also provides direction to MMB regarding disability policies and employment. And most importantly, it codifies and clarifies the roles and responsibilities of ADA coordinators in our state agencies. The role of the ADA coordinator is very important, and it is not standardized across our state enterprise system. Each department has different, the ADA coordinator plays a different role. It has a different level of authority in each department, and this bill would standardize that across their state agencies. And the Minnesotans often face difficult or even insurmountable barriers in finding and maintaining employment. The state of Minnesota is no exception. Unfortunately, Minnesota does not have adequate disability representation in its workforce. Far too often, policies that significantly impact Minnesotans with disabilities are decided by a small group of non-disabled policymakers. Minnesotans with disabilities need not only our voices to be heard, but a seat at the state governing table. This is a Nothing About Us Without Us bill, which would require more consultation with people with disabilities and those who are disability employment experts. Increasing disability employment and retention among the state government workforce creates a pipeline of future leaders and policymakers in our state enterprise system. When Minnesotans with disabilities make decisions in our agency, the disability community in our state will be better represented in and better served by our state government. Thank you, Chair, and yield for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. I see that we have one more testifier, Maria Rodriguez Dively. Thank you. Mm-hmm. If you would please identify yourself for the record and then testify.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. My name is Maria Rodriguez Dively, and I'm a former state employee. Even as a child, I always had a passion to improve the spaces I occupy. Growing up in an island of Puerto Rico, my parents never set limits to what my dreams were and what I could achieve. But unfortunately, as I grew, moved to the mainland, society made a dream smaller and sometimes shattered them altogether. This narrative is all too common for people of color like myself and shared by some of my friends and former colleagues with disabilities. Working for the state was one of my biggest goals that I wanted to achieve. As a freelance sign language interpreter, I've had the privilege to work and walk these halls with advocates who speak on platforms just like this one today, and having one-on-one meetings with legislators representing their districts. Seeing the need, the passion, and the advocacy galvanized me to be a part of the system in hopes to change it. Still, one thing was difficult for me. Not only did I feel like I already had an uphill battle as a woman of color, often categorized as part of the majority, but also my non-apparent disability. Unlike peers who don't have the privilege to choose to disclose or not disclose their race, ethnicity, and disability, I was hesitant to apply for the Connect 700 program. To me, that was a neon sign disclosing what society already looked at as a flaw and limited my chances of achieving my goals of making Minnesota a better place. With encouragement from my amazing partner, who some of you have had the chance to meet, I've received my Connect 700 certification and eventually obtained employment in one of the disability-focused divisions of the state. I will tell you, I was lucky to be a part of a division who understood, celebrated, and accommodated people with disabilities without fear of being an inconvenience or an additional liability or expense. Working with the division built my confidence and helped me collect the shattered dreams I once let go of and adhere them together with gold. I felt such confidence that I decided after 2 years to move to a different agency in a higher position, not only to grow towards my dream, but to be a leader. Little did I realize that the same celebration and understanding was not a core standard for all agencies statewide. As you can conclude by how I introduced myself, my time at the state after my move to this agency was short-lived, and I resigned after 3 months, meaning I didn't even conclude my 700 hours. Unfortunately, this story is too common for people with disabilities that are employed by the state, regardless if they utilize Connect 700 or obtain employment by more traditional employment paths. This bill will help people with disability not only obtain state jobs, but stay in them. And that's what we want in the first place. We want to hire, but we also want to retain and build and grow and have leadership and be able to make changes in policies like the bill states. This bill codifies the Dayton and Walt Executive Order. It improves the implementation and execution of the Connect 700 program. It provides direction to MMB regarding disability policies and employment. It codifies but also clarifies the roles and responsibilities of ADA coordinators in state agencies, standardizes the training and hiring managers and ADA coordinators across all state agencies, establishes a data collection and reporting structure to an advancement of employees with disabilities. And thank you so much for listening to my story. I might no longer be an employee of the state, but my passion to make and change this state still is unwavered. I truly believe that Minnesota could be a model state employer for people with disabilities, and I look forward to your support in achieving this goal. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I would just like to say, as a Minnesotan, this is your house and your testimony matters. So thank you very much for being here today. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify? Okay, then we thank you very much. And we will move to member questions. Is there any discussion or questions? We have two members. Representative Harder, did you wish to ask a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just need some clarification. I just have two questions, I guess. Okay, so on the fiscal report, it mentions frequently about this C700 program. Can someone please clarify what that is? And then my second question in the bill, this would be under it's on page 7.6. So it says qualified applicants should be converted to permanent probationary appointments. So this is where my question is. Are the applicants then permanent or probationary? I just need clarification on that one. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Harder. Mr. Turner, are you wishing to answer?
Yes, please absolutely. Thank you, Representative, for your question. So the Connect 700 program is a program that is administered by the Management and Office of Management and Budget. It's a hiring program that allows people with disabilities, significant disabilities, to bypass the traditional hiring process and demonstrate on-the-job capabilities of doing the position for 700 hours. After 700 hours, which is roughly 3 months, then if the person is able to demonstrate that they are able to do the job, then they go into a probationary period, which is the six-month probationary period that is normal for every employee starting a new job at the state. So the 700 hours don't count towards the probationary period.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Representative Harder. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer. This is a I'm very interested in this. I happen to work for the county, and we do the mandatory ADA training every year. And normally, I don't like those trainings, but the next one, I'll be more enthusiastic to do it. My question actually has to do with the capacity of the 700 program. What number? How many people can we accommodate? Because I think this is super important. And how many people can we accommodate in that 700? Our program at one time, and does it have cohorts that revolve through the year, or just give me the capacity components of that program, please.
Thank you. Mr. Turner?
Yeah. So the Connect 700 program is a pretty straightforward program in that it really just depends on how many positions are available. And most positions in the state are Connect 700 eligible positions. Right now, it's hard to say that we don't have that data. And that's one of the things that this bill does is start collecting that data so we have a better idea of some of the things that you're asking. But I do know for the, for the hiring, about 2019, 2020, it was reported that about 50% of people with disabilities who work for the state left their positions within a year because of a lot of reasons, but including their accommodations not being met or their hiring manager being discriminatory and not understanding their disability or not understanding the program and how it works. And so that the goal is to eliminate that.
Thank you very much. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. And hopefully, as this goes on, I'm very much in support of this, and hopefully as this goes on, we also look at the employment supports that this population needs as they're, retaining their employment. I think it's just as important to do that and identify where we need to maybe do a better job for these folks. So thank you.
Representative Bryant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Yes, and this goes beyond the hiring. It's also about the retention. And so I think you'll find that this legislation is designed to do exactly what you mentioned. I just want to put a plug in for the report. It's available online. I can make a link available. And it also has data in it in the appendices about the types of things you might be interested in related to people who are choosing to leave employment with the state and the reasons.
Thank you, and I would just make a note for anyone who's interested. On the Minnesota Nonpartisan House Research link, you can get a copy of the report. It's right there for everybody.
Perfect.
So thank you. Representative Nash, did you have a question or would you like to close?
I don't have any, So I appreciate having a fiscal note. That's a good thing. I do have questions, though, regarding and either to the author or maybe House fiscal staff. Page 2 of the bill, subdivision 1A, subdivision 18A, there's the accommodation fund.
Could you just make this easy for the audience and just give us the line number?
Or sure, lines 2.6 through 2.10, but primarily 2.16 and 2.2 through 2.21.
Thank you.
The digital accessibility, I was reading the fiscal note and maybe I missed where the appropriation for the technology piece of this is. I read it a couple times. Am I missing where that appropriation is listed in the fiscal note, or can someone help me with that?
Ms. Roberts?
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, this bill does not have an appropriation in it. I don't know if there's anyone from MMP who can clarify this, but I think if you look under the assumptions, the very first assumption, it says that MMB's technology is already required to be accessible, that there will be a cost to making MMB's technology usable behind simply accessible, but those costs are unknown.
And Ms. Roberts, I just want to make sure I'm clear on what you're saying. It is already the understanding that MMB will make their IT services accessible.
That's correct.
Thank you. Representative Nash.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I don't know how much that's going to cost. There will be some additional things, I'm sure, that go into that. I certainly support the idea of the bill, support what's going on. But I do know that in talking through the technological needs, that there will be some costs. Don't know what that is. Maybe we could find that out. I'm not going to hold or make a fuss over this. But I do think that it would be a good idea to at least be able to, for the author to say, talking to MMB, here's how much we're looking at, because I want this to be something that is available to these employees. We should be doing this, but it does have a cost. So it's always good to, when we know we have to do something and we should do something, to know what the commensurate cost is. So that's all I have.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. I appreciate your support and I take your point. I think it's very valid and I'll be exploring that.
Thank you very much. Do you have any closing words before we call the vote?
Madam Chair, just my thanks for your support for this important issue. I want to make sure that we are living our values as a state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All of those in favor of holding the bill over for possible inclusion, please say aye.
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to move it again. I renew my motion to recommend House File 383 be laid over for possible inclusion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails. Okay, next we will have Representative Aka. Representative Aikum, welcome to the committee. You are here to discuss with us House File 1213. Since you were not a member of the committee, I will recommend that House File 1213 be laid over for possible inclusion. Would you like to state your name for the record and present your bill?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Representative Patty Aikum. Excuse me. I'm here to talk about House File 1213, which is a bill to remove the compensation cap on local government officials. And I will say currently we have kind of a patchwork landscape on those cities that are being held to this compensation cap and those that are not. And so there's a process that jurisdictions can apply to with the Minnesota Management and Budget to be an exception. Their community can be an exception from this compensation cap. And so we see there is a long list, I believe it was a part of your packets, dozens of jurisdictions that are not being held to that standard. And so it And because of that, it has some challenges. I will say that in this job market, as we know, it's a tight labor market. And so competition to attract and retain qualified staff is challenging. I used to serve on a city council prior to coming to the legislature, so I know how important it is to get good staff for our local governments, and want to make sure that the cities and counties and other jurisdictions have that opportunity. So the challenge of having neighboring cities maybe that are not being held to the cap can make it challenging, and they can be attracted away by the neighboring communities that are doing better or having better opportunities for pay. And I will also say Minnesota is an exception as far as a state. We are surrounded by states that do not have these caps, and I think there was also a letter submitted talking about some of the pay within the cities in our neighboring communities. And so coming from local government, I think it's important that we have local control. I think that it's important that our city councils and county boards are able to pay their staff accordingly for the important work they do. And so I think that it's important that we allow them to do that. Councils are elected, and so they are held accountable to the decisions that they make. And also to say local jurisdictions have to publicly list the top three staff that they have, top highest paid. And so there's a whole lot of transparency in how jurisdictions do their government and pay their employees. And so I think that for voters to be able to see that and recognize if that's something they agree with or not, they can certainly make their views heard to their community. So I think that it is time that we remove the cap, given the patchwork of communities we have around the state that are exempt from this already. And so with that, I do have some, I will just also mention there were several letters of support that were sent into the committee that should be part of your packet. And there are a few testifiers that I have with me today.
Thank you very much, Representative Aikum. We have four individuals listed to testify. We will begin with Patrick Keene, then move to Rebecca Schnack, followed by Mr. Mossman, and then with Mr. Carlson. So if Patrick Keene would please come forward. Welcome, council member. If you would please state your name and begin your testimony, that would be wonderful.
Very good. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Patrick Keene, and I'm a council member from the City of Rochester. This is my first time testifying in person, and I'm here to speak in support of House File 1213. I've been on our council for the past 5 years, and I'm just starting my third year serving the Board of Directors for our Rochester Public Utilities, the largest municipal public utility in the state. Our utility has over 57,000 electric customers and 41,000 water customers. When I testified via Zoom 2 years ago on the salary cap, I spoke about losing one of our highest leaders in the public utility to another state. Today, the issue remains very relevant for us both as a city and a public utility. Our long-serving general manager has announced his intention to retire later this year, and so we've started the recruiting process. Given the large portfolio of specific skills for a utility, we went seeking out professional recruiting firms, and we did hear back from some, but one I do want to share you. One particular firm came back and said that they would like to work with a city like Rochester, but their company will no longer work with Minnesota cities because of the recruiting and the state salary cap is too big of a barrier for their processes. Mm-hmm. The City of Rochester is also going to be to begin work to fill positions of finance director and public works over the next 2 years, and we know we're going to run into these kind of problems, and it's one of the reasons we're here speaking to you today. The state salary cap is a retention issue, along with being a recruiting issue. At some point, salary caps can become a demotivator to stay in public sector jobs in Minnesota. Top positions in smaller cities on our borders know about our pay scales, and they selectively recruit our top employees because of it. And over time, private sector companies come to understand the salary constraints, and they know how to make competitive offers, especially in the areas of like cybersecurity and finance and civil engineers. In closing, I do want to state clearly that city councils like ours in Rochester take our fiduciary responsibilities as our critical success factor. In Rochester's case, our combined city services budget is over $600 million for 2023. We approve a tax levy each year, and we're responsible to our voters each election. And in between elections, we hear feedback from residents and from businesses. City councils know that our local revenue and budgets are limited, so financial decisions are made with the utmost care. With this understanding, I encourage you to eliminate the state's artificial cap and allow city councils to address their topics, just as we do with city budgets, with community development decisions, and with other matters that have local impact. And with that, I'll wait for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Keene. Next, we will have Rebecca Schnack. Welcome, council member. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Rebecca Schack. I'm a council member for the City of Minnetonka. I'm here today to support local control and the repeal of the compensation caps that we're forced to adhere to. As an elected official, we should have the discretion to make the decisions about the salary and hiring of the executive, particularly executive levels of our city staff. The restrictions are artificially limiting our candidate pool, especially when we're looking at hiring positions like city manager, city attorney, and other director level positions. Minnetonka recently went through a recruiting search process for our city manager, and when we were interviewing placement agencies and recruiters for the position, we narrowed it down to three recruiters. And to a person, one of the things they wanted to make very clear to us was that the candidate pool would be artificially limited due to the salary cap restrictions in Minnesota, which incidentally is the only state that has such restrictions. Specifically, one of our priorities in Minnetonka was to attract a diverse candidate pool, and because the experience and the diversity of candidates available within the state was fairly limited, we knew that we would probably have to look to folks from other states. It was just very difficult to attract them because of these salary cap limits, especially in a place like Minnesota, which has a highly skilled and highly trained workforce, and obviously many private corporations that can beat us on pay. That's the bottom line. We want to compete with the market. We want to attract the best people. That is a fiscally responsible thing to do. I think it's, we all know that recruiting and hiring is a significant expense. If we can keep folks working for us at our city level, that will save us money in the long run, even if it means we're paying them slightly higher salaries. The compression is also an issue. If we have directors who, in the city of Minnetonka, we've got public works, community development, city attorneys, all who have been with the city for many years, they are incredibly valuable resources for us. They are pushing up against the salary cap as well. There really is an incentive for those folks to look to take that next step to the city manager position, to be on call 24/7, to have added responsibility when there's really no financial incentive to take that on. The bottom line, again, to reiterate, my colleagues, is we're just looking for control as elected officials to make the decisions about compensation that we feel is most appropriate for our respective cities. Thank you so much for your time today, and I appreciate you considering the bill.
Thank you, Council Member Schack. Next, we will have Gary Mossman, Matthew Mossman, followed by Gary Carlson. Sorry about that.
Thank you. Good morning. Matt Mossman with the Minnesota Inter-County Association testifying in support of House File 1213 this morning. MICA represents 15 of Minnesota's larger and faster growing counties, including 4 suburban and 11 greater Minnesota counties. House File 1213 restores the market-based approach to setting compensation levels for local officials, and it strengthens local control and accountability by aligning the authority for making compensation decisions with the local elected officials who are accountable for the work performance of the persons hired. Thank Representative Acom for authoring this legislation. Like all counties, our members are responsible for a complex array of public functions, many of which are required by the state and administered in partnership with the state. Just to give a quick partial scope of county governments, they administer all of the health and human social service programs in the purview of DHS, state and federal programs, as well as public health, local public safety, and supervision. Roughly 88% of the probation caseload that would otherwise be the responsibility of DOC. A network of local transportation infrastructure that exceeds the lane miles of the state trunk highway system. Housing, elections, property tax reform, land use, parks and trails, solid waste, and on. You know what counties do. That's the role of counties. Counties embrace that work and do an excellent job of it. Recruiting, hiring, retaining the skills and expertise needed to lead that work is fundamental to successful outcomes. The compensation limit in the Minnesota statutes effectively entrusts counties to perform all of those functions, but then limits the decision-making authority for local governing bodies over these basic compensation decisions. The compensation limit severs the links between pay decisions and political accountability. Compensation for both public and private employers is fundamental to performance management, to retention, and especially for the executive leadership and highly technical and competitive skills such as IT, engineers, human service experts that are highly competitive in the workplace, with real consequences for the level of playing field and retention. Counties report significant salary compression as pay has risen over time, but has been capped for top salaries. One county described out-of-state recruits withdrawing from consideration upon learning of the cap. Other counties point out that it prevents their local pay for performance strategies from working effectively. We included in your, I had a handout, and I just want to speak to that because I think it helps illustrate that Minnesota local government employers, it's a regional and national marketplace, and increasingly so. I don't want to suggest that those necessarily are the right levels or the levels that would be paid or the skill levels that they're comparison in terms of what is needed. The point is, that's a local case-by-case decision-making, but it's clear that local elected officials in other states are increasingly paid at higher levels than many are in Minnesota. We appreciate that there is a waiver process, but it hasn't always worked with, it sometimes has yielded confounding results, and everybody is trying to, including MMB, is trying to do their best within the statutes as they are written. But we have at least one situation in recent years where a county experienced a very frustrating situation where their waiver request was denied because they weren't, you know, sort of in the top five of the size of counties, while a city in that county, which is the third largest city, was granted a waiver request. Same marketplace, same job market, very similar skill sets. That's how the process works. In the end of the day, House File 1213 is a better solution to let local elected officials make these local decisions, and we would appreciate your support, and I'll stick around for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mossman. Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Gary Carlson. I work with the League of Minnesota Cities. We represent 837 of the 854 cities across the state, soon to be 855 cities across the state. I want to testify in support of House File 1213 and thank Representative Akam for carrying this bill. We've been working on this issue for many years. This has been before this committee, as many of you know, I think for each of the last three biennia, and we really want to get this across the finish line. Let me just say, accentuate a few points. I think Councilmember Keene and Councilmember Shack had some very good examples locally. But let me just say that the waiver process really is cumbersome and doesn't work very well. We have to come to MMB. MMB has to assess a job. Now, can you imagine being a state agency official trying to determine what a fire chief should make in some Minnesota city? They are charged with a very difficult task. But not only that, the recommendations of MMB must go to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, and they have the opportunity to weigh in as well. That is a process that, in my recollection, has only happened a couple of times in the last decade where the SEC has actually met to consider these. And the last time I recall sitting in one of those committee meetings, none of the members, many of you who may have served on that, really could understand how this process would work or how they could make an effective judgment about what the compensation should be for an individual position in an individual city or county. So with that, I do want to acknowledge that there is a inflation adjustment that's applied to the cap every year. That's great. The problem is we have a serious market, a labor market problem right now. We're having a very difficult time attracting and retaining employees. In Minnesota right now, I think we have about two jobs for every one job seeker, and I think in the public sector, it's even a worse ratio. And when Minnesota is hamstrung with this law, it makes it hard for our local governments to attract and retain employees. Madam Chair, I encourage your support for the bill, and I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We do have two members on the list right now. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the testimony, and Mr. Carlson and a few of the other testifiers talked about the waiver process. I wonder if maybe we just need to refine the waiver process to make it make the system work a little bit easier. But I'm wondering about the history of when this came in and you know, who's being protected here other than the taxpayers. But it was indicated to me that maybe certain counties are being protected at the expense of other counties. And if one of the testifiers would mind commenting on that.
Representative Akam, who would you wish to address that question?
I will turn that over to Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, individual counties and cities can claim waiver or file waiver requests. And if a county or a city isn't, you know, quick at responding with a waiver request, if they have an employee that is being lured away or they have a job position where they didn't expect the market forces to be driving up the compensation necessary to attract and retain people. So you can have, and you do have, in fact, there's a list of probably 50 or 60 waiver requests that have come in, some of which have been approved and some of which haven't been approved. But really, as Mr. Mossman said, I think the situation he was referring to was Olmsted County in particular, where they had a waiver request in at the same time the city of Rochester did. And Rochester, being the third largest city in the state, was granted their waiver request. Olmsted County is not in the top, as Mr. Mossman said, top, you know, 10 or so counties in terms of population, which is one of the criteria used by MMB to assess what a compensation limit should be. And so they were not granted. That was in the same year, as I recall. So it can really depend upon how MMB does evaluate those jobs. We're not blaming MMB. We think it's an impossible task for them to try to assess what that compensation might be.
You, Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Kosnick, I think it's really important that you talk about protecting the taxpayer, and that is something I think all jurisdictions hold very, very dear. And I don't think we're protecting the taxpayer when we aren't allowing, when we're hampering jurisdictions to be able to attract and retain employees that are going to serve their communities well. And so I think there is a unintended consequence to this. I don't think this was put in place to hamper jurisdictions. I think the unintended consequence is that it is.
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate that, Representative Akam. I guess I've been opposed to this, and I'm just trying to figure out a little bit more of the history of it. It was kind of indicated that this was an attempt, if someone can correct me, but it was indicated to me, and I don't know that it's for certain, that maybe it was protecting Hennepin County employees from coming in and working in other parts of the state with the salary cap, or if something like that. So that was interesting to me as it was indicated, and I don't know that that's true, but if someone wants to expound on that, that would be great. But then I do want to note that I appreciate, you know, this flyer from the Inter-County Association, and they do have a disclaimer on there that the salaries listed on there for the committee members that have not been verified for accuracy. There has a county sheriff in North Dakota with a salary of something well over $520,000. It was indicated to me that that sheriff in that particular county makes about $128,000. So I appreciate the disclaimer that that information isn't completely correct, but honest mistake there. But I just think, we, looking at the different testifiers here, and, previously in this committee, we had my own city of Lakeville come in advocating for this. And since then, we've been able to hire an excellent police chief and a new director of economic development. And they are not even in the top three of the highest paid staff in Lakeville, and proud to have them on staff. They're doing a wonderful job. Taking a look at the city of Rochester that testified in Minnetonka as well, I believe 110% of the governor's salary is like $127,000-something, and the top people in Minnetonka and Rochester they still have room to grow in that salary range. But is there other than the actual wage, are there other retention strategies that have been implemented that I think would be around just the flat salary in terms of retirement? So when it says compensation, is that how we're talking about retention, other retirement packages that can be enhanced? Are we, I think those are salaries or strategies that could be looked at. Are cities and counties prohibited from enhancing other benefits rather than just regular salary?
Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, it is a compensation limit, not just a salary limit. So the short answer to your question is no, those opportunities don't exist. So there's some finery around what that means, but in general, the only benefits that can be provided outside of the compensation calculation are benefits at levels that are generally available to all other employees within the jurisdiction. So, for example, if there was a car benefit that would be included within compensation.
Representative Akam, and then we'll move on to Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will only say that removing the cap doesn't mean that jurisdictions have to pay them more. It just means that they have the option to. And so cities such as Lakeville and others, there's no requirement. It just means that they have another tool in their toolbox to be able to attract and retain the best employees.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you. I want to just say I appreciate this bill. you know, we have a bit of a push-pull happening here. There's a what works in theory versus in practice, and I appreciate that Representative Akin pointed out that, you know, in theory, back in 2005, we put this in place to really get at that whole idea of fiscal responsibility, protecting the taxpayer, which, of course, is the goal that I think we all strive for in this room, to be candid. But in practice, you know, this is really difficult. I think in government we have two roles here: one, to make government more efficient, and two, to reflect. And at the same time, we need to reflect the reality on the ground in terms of the marketplace. You know, one of the examples that come to mind for me is often the IT positions, which was mentioned here earlier. For example, our CISO, there's sort of a running joke that your chief information security officer is often a traveling person, right? They're not expected to stay for very long because they are easily lured away to other jobs and other places outside of state employment where they have a little bit less responsibility and a lot better benefits and pay. So I appreciate this bill for that reason, that it really is giving us the opportunity to say, you know, while in theory this was a great practice in law, it may not in reality be the best thing for the state at this time. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And wanted to thank the author for stopping me to chat through this. And I've opposed this for a long time. And there's a couple of reasons that I do that. And the first is we're talking about the ability to attract and retain all employees by the city councils, and we're talking about local control. Well, having served on the city council, you only have one employee. It's the city administrator. All other employees work for the city administrator or the city manager. So, and it's kind of a somewhat disingenuous argument in that vein, because you're not setting the rates for multiple people. It's set for the top, and then, as Mr. Carlson and I talked about and agreed yesterday, it then affects what's called steps and lanes. It also re-indexes the entirety of everybody below that city administrator, and that's just fact. So I guess I don't mind the waiver process. I think that it's actually a pretty good process. I just feel that what is a potential of what happens is that we wind up having the implication or the impact, sorry, the impact go to the taxpayer without really having the ability to have a full-throated conversation like we would on this. In my experience, and mind you, this was several years ago, but when we would have a step and lane increase, and lanes are based on experience or degree programs that you may have, you then expand out your ability to seek higher compensation. But that's, again, indexed off of what the city administrator is making. So that becomes potentially quite expensive for the taxpayer. And, you know, to the comment of earlier that private corporations can just pay people more money, well, that's because they're using private capital. When we pay public officials, we're using taxpayer money. And I just think that having another way to regulate this or slow it down to have a more thoughtful and deeper conversation is probably where we should stay. I certainly recognize that attracting and retaining is important, but I forget who talked about it, but there were things that we put into the contract for our city administrator that the city would provide a car allowance. So that was a benefit. I think Representative Kosnick asked that question. So there are things that are malleable in that, but I have great reticence in doing this, so I'll be voting no. That's my personal vote. I'm not trying to dictate how my folks here vote. I just think that for Jim Nash, I'm not a yes. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Akin, would you like to close?
Thank you for the opportunity this morning. I appreciate the conversation and the comments. I do think it's important that we allow our local jurisdictions to have the opportunity to pay their staff or to attract staff. I think there's something to be said about you get what you pay for, and I don't want us to be local jurisdictions and government to only be attracting those mediocre candidates. We want really good qualified people running our cities and our counties. And so I thank you for the opportunity and appreciate your support today.
Thank you. And I'll thank you for bringing the bill forward. I should have said this before you gave your closing, but I really believe that we have high quality, high caliber individuals serving in our local and state government. And I don't believe that we should ask them to accept less because they've stepped into the public arena. So with that, members, is there any further discussion? Seeing none, we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Representative Wogamont. Welcome to the committee, Representative Wogamont. Since you are not a member of state and local government, I will move that House File 1199 be recommended to be placed on the general register. And with that, I would ask that you please state your name for the record and present your bill.
Well, thank you for that, Madam Chair, and Lead Nash and members of the committee. I am Dan Wogamont, representative from District 14B, and I'm here to present House File 1199. I do have an author's amendment. I don't know if, Madam Chair, if it would be your preference that we move that first before we get into explaining the bill.
Oh, my apologies. I did not see the DE1. Yes. I will move that the DE1 be before the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The DE1 amendment simply takes three bills that govern changes requested by the Minnesota State Retirement System, the Public Employee Retirement Association, and the Teachers Retirement Association, takes those three bills and combines them into one so that we can have this all before us going forward.
Okay. Were there any questions or comments regarding the DE1? Then we'll put the bill in the all those in favor of adopting the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the bill 1199 as amended is now before the committee. Please proceed.
Well, thank you for that, Madam Chair. Again, this bill governs changes requested by MSRS, PARA, and TRA. As I'm sure you know, these pensions plans submit these annual administrative bills to clean up sections of their governing statutes. Some of these changes are technical, some of them are substantive. And with that, Madam Chair, we'll ask our staff to do a quick overview of the bill.
Ms. Lincheski, welcome to the committee. Would you please be willing to walk through?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Susan Lincheski. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. I would note that the commission took up all three bills and did approve them all as part of this DE1 unanimously at their meeting on February 6th. I'll do a very quick overview of the DE1 in front of you. Article 1 deals with the Minnesota State Retirement System. Section 1, specifically the State Patrol Plan. It reduces the number of days prior to beginning a pension that a member can apply to begin the pension from 90 to 60 days for the State Patrol Plan. This will make this plan consistent with the other MSRS plans on this topic. Sections 2, 3, and 4 deal with the judge's plan. Members of the judge's plan already have a federally protected right to purchase credit for periods of military service. The amendment adds an additional right that applies when a judge misses the deadline for paying for that service and is able to then purchase the service anyway. It will cost a little bit more money for the judge, but it does provide them with this additional right to purchase credit for periods of military service. This, too, will make this plan consistent with the other MSRS plans on this topic. Section 4 just repeals an obsolete section. Article 2 deals with the Public Employees Retirement Association, or PARA. Sections 1 and 2 changes. Employees of cities and counties are required to participate in PARA if they will exceed an annual salary threshold. That threshold is $5,100 for a calendar year employee. The change to that is to make it a monthly threshold of $425. This will address some administrative problems that PARA has been having with this administering an annual threshold. Sections 3, 6, 12, and 14 all revise the definition of dependent child for all the pension plans administered by PARA so that they are the same definition. A child is considered a dependent child under the new definition until age 23. Sections 4 and 5 revise provisions permitting members to purchase salary credit for periods of reduced salary, such as on a leave of absence. This will bring the statutes into conformity with the way PARA administers these purchases. Sections 7 through 11 and 13 adds new definitions to one chapter, Chapter 353E, for the local government correctional plan. This adds definitions for plan, fund, and most importantly, member. This last is significant in that it corrects omissions throughout the chapter relating to changes made in 2002 when a second category of member became eligible for the plan. In addition to the original category, local government correctional service employees in 2002, medical center protection officers also became eligible, but the chapter had not been amended throughout to reflect this new additional membership category. The bill changes that to fix that omission. And the final article is Article 3, which deals with the Teachers Retirement Association. That has one section which revises the eligibility or the criteria for executive director. This will make this plan consistent with the other two statewide funds. It expands the criteria to change it from at least 5 years of experience on the staff of a major retirement system to a broader criteria, which will permit the TRA board to entertain candidates who have at least 5 years of experience in management of a plan or in a position responsible for governance, management, or administration. It's thought that the there may be a change in the executive directorship over at TRA, and so this will allow the board to entertain a larger pool of candidates. And that's those are my comments.
Thank you, Ms. Lincheski. Representative Wogum, do you have any further discussion? Member questions? Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that this bill is a very bipartisan bill. It came out of the commission, I think, with a unanimous vote, if I remember correctly. And Ms. Lincheski, thanks for the work that you do. You always present in a very Sergeant Joe Friday kind of way, just the facts, and I appreciate that. I do particularly appreciate the change for the State Patrol. I know that that's been something that we've been trying to get done, I think, for a couple of years now. So once again, thank you very much for the bill, and that this is something that is just fine, in my opinion, to move on. Thank you.
Representative Nash, I didn't ask you about this bill earlier. Is this one that you think we could move to the consent agenda?
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe that as we dip our toe in the water for the consent calendar, I think that we could feel comfortable, and I would even make the motion to move it to the consent calendar. I know that I think the rules say that we both have to make that motion.
We can make a joint motion.
Maybe Mr. Guerin can correct us, kick us back into play. I know we might have argued like cats and dogs on the floor regarding the rules, but I think it does require both of us to agree to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash and Cleaborn, I don't have the rule right in front of me, so I don't recall exactly what the phrasing is for the obligation, but I know you do both need to agree to the motion to move the consent calendar.
Madam Chair, I think we can create a kumbaya moment and just both agree that we'll move it on.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Representatives Nash and Cleaborn offer a joint motion to recommend House File 1199 as amended to be moved to the consent calendar of the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the joint recommendation is made to move House File 1199 as amended to the consent agenda of the General Register. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Lead Nash. Thank you, committee members.
I hope I can remember how to say that again. Yeah. Thank you. The next bill before us is Representative Lilly. Thank you, Representative Lilly. I would like to welcome you to the committee. And we have before us, I would like to move House File 800 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. If you would like to, we now have the bill before us, if you'd like to present the bill, and we'll move forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. It's nice to be back. I've been a couple of years since I've been before, in person anyways, State Gov Finance. So House File 800 is a bill that ratifies two collected bargaining agreements between the state employees and the executive branch. And last year we passed, I think it was 18 other contracts, and these are the two that are outstanding, so we're trying to catch up. So it's playing back onto past efforts and getting everybody kind of up to speed, and then we'll be for you later with other contracts that are negotiated between the executive branch and the labor groups for the current biennium. The contracts are pretty straightforward. The Minnesota Government and Engineers Council employees and the Minnesota State Colleges. And then there's some MOUs, Memorandums of Understanding. And those are quite interesting. Their contracts are already finished. So there's some other things that, and you've been hearing this all morning, that are struggling with incentives to keep employees. So some of these are fitting with the morning's discussion, certainly, and trying to get retention, which has not been been easy in the state of Minnesota. Clearly, just like the private market, the state has struggled with that, and there's shortages. I had a fact that was brought to me this morning that was interesting. In Department of Health on Subdivision 3, there's almost 30% vacancies at one time during COVID. So that was almost 400 vacancies. But there's a couple things of interest just before I get to the real smart person of the whole group here. But, you know, there's some good things in here and to try to retain. But one of the things that was interesting to me that stands out is we, as a state, we've some of our firefighters are sent. And we kind of have a mutual aid, so our firefighters will often go to other places. And so there's federal law that these employees would get a rest time to regroup before they get thrown back into their local fire departments or whatever. DNR, these are actually DNR, not public firefighters. Sorry, I'm wrong. Back to the DNR. And so this gives them a time to recoup, and it matches up with federal government. But there's all sorts of things like that are in here, retention and different things to get the employees up to speed. With me, I have Michelle Weber, who's, like I said, is with the Subcommittee of Employee Relations, SER, and she works with the legislature to broker with the executive branch. We also have MMB folks in the crowd later on if we need other questions answered. But Michelle Weber, I'd like to pass it to her, and she could kind of go through the bill and see what's really in there.
Thank you, Ms. Weber, for being with us today. If you would state your name for the record, and then please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Michelle Weber with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and we provide staff administrative support to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. Section 1, Subdivision 1 of the bill provides ratification for the Minnesota Government Engineering Council, and that covers about 1,123 employees. It provides a 2.5% across-the-board increase on July 1st, 2021, as well as July 1st, 2022. It also continues step increases for employees who are eligible, for engineers who are eligible, of approximately 3.9%. And there's approximately 35% of the engineers that are not at the top of their salary and would be eligible for that step increase. Section 1, Subdivision 2, provides ratification of the Minnesota State College Faculty Agreement. That covers 3,961 faculty at the community and technical colleges. And this provides a step increases averaging 3.2% for faculty that meet certain criteria. And it also provides a $1,700 across-the-board increase for all faculty. The increased costs of each of those agreements for the Minnesota Government Engineering Council in the current biennium, it's a 4.32% increase, and then in the future, in the next biennium, it's a 6.56% increase to the overall costs of the agreements. The Minnesota State College Faculty Agreement has a 3.57% increase in this current biennium to the cost of the agreement and a 5.10% cost in the next biennium. Section 2 of the bill, as Representative Lilly mentioned, ratifies several memorandums of understanding that were submitted to the subcommittee since the last legislative session adjourned, and those memorandums of agreement are similar to several memorandums of understanding that were ratified last legislative session for other agreements that were already in place that provide recruitment and retention incentives. They offer provide coverage for employees who may need to miss work due to a child who may be quarantining. They also provide, as Representative Lilly mentioned, rest and recuperation leave for DNR employees who are returning from firefighting in other jurisdictions. There are some incentives for certain Minnesota lottery employees who meet certain sales goals, as well as pay differential for Department of Revenue employees who may be working in other states with and in cities with higher costs of living, wage rates for certain DHS employees. It establishes some compensation for employees at the state academies to attend training sessions, and it also permits the Secretary of State to offer achievement awards to the AFSCME employees. The final section of the bill provides an effective date immediately upon passage. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and it's my understanding that someone from Minnesota State as well as MMB is here as well.
Is anyone else wanting to testify, or should we move to member questions? Okay. Member questions? Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the work here, Representative Lilly, and Ms. Weber. I work with you on a couple other things. You do a great job. Thank you for your service. Could you clarify on, I'm just looking at the summary, subdivision 2, the memorandums submitted dealing with incentives up to $10,000 for the Nurse Association. Can you just explain that a little bit for us, if you wouldn't mind?
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative Kosnick, it's my understanding that the agencies offering those retention and recruitment and retention incentives have to develop a plan approved by MMB, and it might be more appropriate for MMB if there's additional information you'd like on that to respond.
Well, Madam Chair, yeah, I just kind of, it says.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Incentives up to $10,000 after developing a policy that governs the eligibility and parameters of the program and receiving approval from MMB. So I'd kind of like a little bit more information. If somebody from MMB is here to clarify that for us, I think that would be appreciated.
Thank you, and please come forward. If you'd state your name for the record, please, and then proceed with the answer.
Hi, good morning, Chair Cleburne. My name is Jennifer Klesman. I'm the Enterprise Director of Labor Relations at Minnesota Management and Budget. Excuse me. In terms of the plans that the agencies put together, they develop parameters as to target the needs that they are seeing for either recruiting or retention strategies. So with respect to the Minnesota Nurses Association, what we're seeing out in the private sector is higher levels of recruiting incentives, which is where we had worked with the agencies to develop the framework for that. So when an agency is requesting to offer those incentives under the MOU, they would submit the criteria in which they are looking to have those offerings made when they are recruiting or hiring nurses.
Thank you very much. Representative Kosnick, a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. It just wasn't clear. So obviously, our nurses played a critical role in our healthcare system, and so the incentives are for nurses doing the work, or is this for someone developing a policy that's recruiting nurses and retaining them? So is it the nurses, or is it somebody developing a program? That's what I'm trying to clarify, if we could.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Chair Cleaver and Representative Posnick, the incentives are for the nurses.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to follow up on that. So in the settlement sheet, does that include the financial impact of those incentives?
And who would you?
Matt, I can respond.
Okay, Ms. Weber.
Okay, Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau. The settlement sheet does not include the incentives because they were negotiated through a memorandum of understanding. What the settlement sheet reflects is the original collective bargaining agreement costs that are anticipated that were settled. So if a collective bargaining agreement included a 2.5% adjustment across the board, that's what the settlement sheet reflects. In many cases, when we received the information from MMB, they didn't quite yet know how many incentives would be offered, and so in several cases, those costs were not quantified yet.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and I'm not trying to be nitpicky. I'm just curious, where does that money come from? If in fact, let's say there's 1,000 incentives, or 100, or 10, or whatever, where does that funding come from?
And the response from MMB. Please again state your name for the record.
Hi, Jennifer Klassman. I am MMB. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. The money is coming from the agency's budget.
Thank you, Ms. Klassman. Any further?
Just one more follow-up.
Representative Nadeau.
So as I read this, and I apologize, this is the first time I've seen a settlement sheet like this from the state. So as I look at this, it looks like there's only one on here that has not been ratified. There's one that's still in a negotiation. Is it this Service Employees International Union that hasn't been ratified yet?
Ms. Glassman. Or Ms. Weber.
Yeah.
Ms. Weber.
Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, the Service Employees International Union was actually an agreement that was ratified during the 2021 session for the current biennium. Okay. You may have also heard that they recently reached a tentative agreement, and that there was a bill introduced, I believe, yesterday in the House that will bring that forward. It usually comes forward through a separate bill because it's under the jurisdiction of the Department of Human Services. So that usually flows separately.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Seeing none. Since Representative Lilly, did you want to close?
No, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Certainly, myself or Ms. Weber will be available for questions if you have any, but I appreciate your support, and we're so blessed as a state to have good workers that are doing good work, and especially during COVID, they really shined, but I appreciate your support this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now with the outstanding committee administrative staff that we have, and Ms. Rudolph, I have the appropriate language. I will move that House File 1199. Oh, sorry, I have the 800. House File 800. I renew my motion to recommend House File 800, but we would like to place it on the general register with a further recommendation that it be placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Seeing none, the motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative and Ms. Weber. Our next meeting will be Thursday, February 16th, 2023. And with that, we are adjourned.